momento cuando los científicos dicen no es el momento de estar todos en la institución educativa, hay que buscar otras medidas preventivas para poder estar en la institución educativa. Estos maestros se han contagiado la semana pasada, por datos que nos da la entidad médica, solo la semana pasada, el primer día de ingreso de los estudiantes, 1757 docentes contagiados. Del reporte que tienen, porque como digo, no dan abasto a atender a todos. De esos 553 al momento están positivos, o de los que atienden, porque como digo, no da abasto para atender a todos. Y aquí la fideoprevisora, que es la culpable de la salud y el magisterio del magisterio colombiano, tampoco responde ni da la cara para atender esta situación de salubridad del país.
A continuación, Elena Villar de RT reporta sobre un informe que apunta que Estados Unidos ha lanzado 46 bombas al día en los últimos 20 años.
¿Se imaginan las reacciones mundiales que se desatarían si un país lanzase una media de 46 bombas cada día? Las amplias coberturas mediáticas explicando tal abuso de autoridad, las masivas movilizaciones pidiendo el fin de tanta violencia, la cantidad de consejos de seguridad de urgencia de la ONU convocados. No lo imaginen, es una realidad y prácticamente no ocupa titulares. Estados Unidos principalmente, aunque también sus aliados, han lanzado al menos 337.000 misiles y bombas en las últimas dos décadas. La mayoría de estos datos son públicos. De hecho, una de las principales fuentes son los resúmenes mensuales de la Fuerza Aérea estadounidense, unos informes que se difunden desde 2007 precisamente para documentar la cantidad de bombas y misiles lanzados por Washington en el exterior, aunque dejaron de ser publicados temporalmente durante 21 meses por orden de Donald Trump. Ahora han vuelto a hacerlo, por lo que podemos dar un repaso a las últimas cifras de la muerte caída del cielo con sello eminentemente estadounidense. Los nuevos datos revelan que desde febrero de 2020, es decir, con Trump y con Biden, Estados Unidos ha lanzado al menos 3.246 bombas sobre Afganistán, Irak y Siria, una disminución significativa respecto al 2019, sobre todo desde la salida de las tropas de Afganistán durante el pasado mes de agosto. Sin embargo, teniendo en cuenta que el último presupuesto de defensa aprobado no hace más que aumentar el gasto militar, parece prematuro o por lo menos inocente pensar que la tendencia va a seguir hacia la baja. Más cuando, al margen de estos datos, expertos y activistas como la ONG Code Pink denuncian que hay ciertas categorías de ataques aéreos que ni siquiera se incluyen en el conteo. Una de ellas, los ataques de helicópteros. La propia publicación especializada Military Times ya publicó un artículo en 2017 titulado "Las estadísticas del ejército sobre ataques aéreos mortales son incorrectas, no han informado sobre miles". En este sentido, la publicación puso como ejemplo los ataques de helicópteros en Afganistán solo en 2016, en total 456 en los que se dispararon misiles y que no figuraron en el conteo oficial. Tampoco se incluyen a las cañoneras AC-130, que por ejemplo destruyeron un hospital de Médicos Sin Fronteras en Afganistán en 2015, o las operaciones de contrainsurgencia o contraterrorismo. Además de los países anteriormente nombrados, otros objetivos han sido Yemen, Líbano, Pakistán, Palestina y Somalia. Dado el nulo éxito que estas intervenciones han tenido en todos esos territorios, cabría felicitar al gobierno estadounidense, por lo menos, por el auténtico logro que supone que la mayoría de la opinión pública ignore el lanzamiento diario de 46 proyectiles aéreos durante dos décadas.
Así llegamos al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got 3/4 of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President Daniel Ortega's Sandinista National Liberation Front is the controlling party in the assembly, so that body's likely to rubber stamp the request.
Your revolution will not happen between these thighs. Your revolution will not happen between these thighs. Your revolution will not happen between these thighs. Not happen between these thighs. Not happen between these thighs. The real revolution ain't about booty size, the Versaces you buys, or the Lexus you drives. And though we've lost Biggie Smalls, baby, your notorious revolution will never allow you to lace no lyrical douche in my bush. Your revolution will not be you killing me softly with Fuji's. Your revolution ain't gonna knock me up without no ring and produce little future MCs. Because that revolution will not happen between these thighs. Your revolution will not sign me in the backseat of a Jeep with LL hard as hell. You know, doing it and doing it and doing it well. You know, and doing it and doing it and doing it well. Your revolution will not be you smacking it up, flipping it, or rubbing it down. Nor will it take you downtown or humping around. Because that revolution will not happen between these thighs. Your revolution will not have me singing, ain't no nigga like the one I got. Your revolution will not be you sending me for no drip, drip, VD shot. Your revolution will not involve me filling your nature rise or helping you fetishize. Because that revolution will not happen between these thighs. No, no, not between these thighs. Oh, my Jamaican brother, no. Your revolution will not make you feel boombastic and really fantastic and have you groping in the dark for that rubber rotten plastic. You will not be touching your lips to my triple dip of French vanilla, butter pecan, chocolate deluxe, or having Akinelli's dream. A 6-foot blowjob machine. You want to subjugate your queen. Think I'm a pussy.
Well, we're about to join the February 3rd, 2022 edition of the Bathrobes Piers Broadsides Show. It's 2 hours, particularly focusing on local internal disputes of the Food Not Bombs organization, concerns by friends of the Food Not Bombs organizations, issues around homeless civil rights for the entire community, but particularly for people who are outside or in their vehicles, and who knows what else. So tag along and you'll hear it.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance. or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So for those of you who've been following controversies at the Food Not Bombs new food area, the town clock between noon and 4, the problems have been most recent eruption of passion and some violence for the moment, briefly, was a series of blows that were struck between Dread Eye and Sammy, both of whom are Food Not Bombs workers. I think an internal dispute may have kind of mushroomed into a physical confrontation regarding Food Not Bombs policies, which you heard talked about on the previous show, about Keith's concerns that there was some kind of deliberate, or if not deliberate, but likely repeated violent episodes created by Sammy, who's a worker with Food Not Bombs, and you've heard him interviewed here on my show before, which Keith feared was maybe being provoked or accelerated or accentuated by some kind of police involvement. He didn't have any, you know, direct written evidence of that, but he said he'd seen a similar attempts to screw up Food Not Bombs organizations in the past in different cities, and he was concerned that this was happening again. He became very passionate about it, and I played some of the exchanges that he had with Sammy and Tyler, who are the two individuals who were asking. Originally, they were asking for changes in policy regarding the location of Food Not Bombs and also the storage containers. There are three storage containers, which Keith and other volunteers have found have been helpful. Some of them have found otherwise. But in storing, so everything does not have to be carried to the Food Not Bombs lot every day. That's become complicated by the fact that the idea would be to keep the storage container on site, which, however, also presents problems because it appears to be kind of more of a sort of a permanent structure, which may have encouraged those wretched homeless people to set up their tents in the area, as they did in Lot 27 for many months. Whether that's a bad thing, of course, is always open for discussion, but it can prompt either a police reaction or a pretext for a police reaction. In any case, the issue was whether Tyler and Sammy could come to Food Not Bombs meetings, and that became a real issue. The audio that I have of this, the conversations that happened on, I think it was either the 31st of January or the 1st of February, a couple days ago, are really blown away by the wind. You can't really hear them very well. I'm going to try playing little bits, but can't really make much of it. The whole thing actually came out in a fairly positive outcome. I was at the Food Not Bombs meal, and Sammy was there today talking peacefully with folks. And Keith did call in and talk to, well, I called Keith, actually, from the Huff meeting, which happens every Thursday at 11 o'clock, for those of you who are interested, at the Sub Rosa Cafe, 703 Pacific. Come on down, have some coffee. And we share reports about what police are up to. In theory, we plot strategies for defending the rights of folks who are outside and stopping police transgressions and other transgressions by would-be vigilante community members. So we don't do much of that these days at Huff. Our membership has shrunk, and there's the old COVID situation. And the community has gotten more conservative, and Huff seems to have gotten more conservative, or at least certainly less active than it was a few decades ago when we began. with all kinds of daily protests. In fact, we began the serving of free food, but free food is still an issue for a lot of people who want to drive it away, and many of us who want to make sure it stays. And so this is the backdrop so that internal controversies can become particularly concerning, because it provides pretexts for the suppression of Food Not Bombs. And Keith gets excited, I think sometimes overexcited, about this possibility. And the question of who's a police agent or not can become magnified and so forth. This is my opinion. There are some who disagree with me and think it's a very serious concern. Others, not so much. In any case, at this meeting a few days ago, I should say, when I visited the town clock a few together and talked with Sammy and talked with some other Food Not Bombs members, they told me that there had been a Monday meeting of Food Not Bombs, and the police had been called by, and it was by Keith. I'm not sure. The implication that I heard was it was by Keith, but I don't know. And Sammy and Tyler were escorted out, though they hadn't engaged in any violence. Though Keith said in a phone conversation that they were disruptive, though that's not been described. That situation was not described by other members of Food Not Bombs, or one other member who gave us an account. Unfortunately, on the same windy day, it was yesterday on Wednesday, might have been Tuesday, and so it's really hard to hear this stuff. I apologize. I need better equipment, of course, but that's how it goes. So you get my secondhand recitation of what I heard. Good luck with that. Of course, for folks who want to get more information, go down to the Food Not Bombs meal and talk to the volunteers. But it seems to be a storm that is somewhat blown over. I mean, Sammy was afraid he was going to be hauled away by probation because Keith was demanding he never come back to the Food Not Bombs area first, that they wouldn't serve him food, but the volunteers didn't like that. They served him anyway. And Keith insisted soon that that isn't really what he meant. He just didn't want them lingering around and with the possibility of violent fights, because Sammy had, in fact, struck one of the volunteers, Dreadeye, in the face, and he had to have several stitches in his face, although he seems to be doing better, and it's not in the hospital or anything, so that's good. And so that's some of the background, which regular listeners have already probably picked up on. But the ultimate outcome of this is Sammy's back at the meal. He has committed himself to not be violent. And Keith says that's okay. Apparently his probation officer, and I haven't talked to Sammy, other than hearing that he was today going to visit his probation officer, and the threat was he might have to go away because a third strike was pending, and he might go off for 7 years to prison. And this was really if it wasn't freaking him out, it was certainly describing it in very graphic terms and saying it was a real concern of his. But so far, he's still on the scene. There's no violence. Keith has said it's fine for Sammy to be there, but there has to be a solemn agreement that if there is any violence, the police will be called and he'll be taken away. Because not just Keith, but other Food Not Bombs volunteers are concerned about that. Some less so, some more so, some not at all. And some are concerned with authoritarian behavior by Keith. Some are concerned with barring people from meetings that shouldn't be done because it's people should not be. It seems to be a denial of a due process and the right of the rest of the Food Not Bombs organization to hear and consensus on it. But it's a situation that seems to have been resolved. And I think what I'm going to I was going to play this dialogue at the clock by some other folks, including Sammy and Garrett, a volunteer. But it's really hard to hear. I'll give you an example of it, and then we'll kind of unfortunately move on. You have to rely on my secondhand account. So beginning with this February 2nd, here's Sammy at the clock in mid-afternoon.
I don't know, eating, being here, and so forth?
Yes, I was telling Keith, like, look, Come here to eat, and they come here to hang out with friends. I want to be able to come here. I'm not going to be causing drama and starting fights and all that. I just want to come here and be in peace. Like, I just want to God, like, I'm not going to be causing problems. I'm not going to be fighting. I'm not going to do anything. I just want to be able to eat and hang out.
He said,
if you act like it happened the last 2 days, no arguing, no fighting, no nothing, that's not going to be peaceful.
And translation, what did Keith say? Well, Keith said if you act as peaceably as you have in the last few days, that's okay. Keith said that to Sammy, according to Sammy's account.
Any problem, you can be here all day. I don't care. So, if you're on the surface, then
but you see, this is really kind of really not worth struggling to hear. So, I'll take a couple more dives into this, and then we'll pass on. But here, the staff are serving you food as you wish?
Yes, the staff are kind of like out of it. They're like, they're here to feed anybody. They don't care about the drama, TV, and whatever. Their aspect is to be hungry for the meat.
What's happening around town? You've seen the...
You are being forced out, and it's just like I heard a couple of days ago some of the people homeless being forced out near the bench, actually near the beach, with evacuation orders and forced to the bench. But still, you got groups of homeless people trying to get together and making it great. Because, like my friend Kazoo, he has a generator, TV, and everything. He's out on the streets watching TV. But it seems like a lot of people during this time with COVID is really starting to link up, and it's like it's hard time.
And I also had a conversation with James, who spoke a lot about the assistance he'd been given by AA, even though he's homeless and had his property stolen. AA suddenly, just out of the blue, when he had just arrived in town and come to a few meetings, they replaced his stuff and gave him blankets, and he expressed great gratitude and appreciation for that. He, of course, tells the story better than I could, but unfortunately, the wind whipped it away. And I'll simply apologize for all that. And let's listen instead to some Food Not Bombs conversations a few days earlier, again at the town clock. They newly arrived there, or could have been either through the first or the second day after Food Not Bombs had moved to the clock. Here's Cooper talking about it. She's at the clock, presumably enjoying a meal, but certainly having a conversation with me.
Bombs, this is Mary.
We're talking with.
This is Cooper.
Today is the 26th of January. Or is it the 27th? Anyway,
it's the 26th, and it's Wednesday.
Thank you, you see. She knows what's going on. And the Food Not Bombs is apparently relocated to the town clock without police interference as of yet. Cooper, have you been observing this whole scene?
Yes. They're doing really great. They've got great food out here. They just moved everything over here and didn't let anything stand in their way, and here we are.
Have the people follow them, or does nobody know where they are?
I'm not sure. I think there are still some people over in the last parking lot area that I think are directing people over here.
We've got the Food Not Bombs traffic cops, so to speak.
Yes.
Dig it. Well, good to see you're in a good mood. Maybe you'll put me in a good mood.
Well, thank you. You should be in a good mood.
Damn right.
I think it's victorious moments coming in our history. Could be tomorrow. Could be like Happy Thanksgiving.
That would be a while off.
Well, I don't know. See, then if you go back to like before Caesar, maybe that time of year, or I don't know.
How did you sleep last night?
I slept well.
And did you sleep in another one of your mystery spots?
I slept well. It was freezing cold, though. And on a real serious note, that there are so many people outside with no shelter, no sleeping bags, no, you know, and I mean, it's, and then if they do get wet or soiled or dirty or whatever from being out in the dirt, it costs them like almost too much money to wash those big blankets. And so it's very sad. It's very sad that we have so many people that still need sleeping bags.
Are most people, there aren't many tents at that previous spot that Food Not Bombs was at, right?
No. I think maybe one person kind of off in the corner.
That's what I remember.
Yeah. And other than that.
When did you miss the fire? What are we missing?
Say that again, Russell.
I said, oh, when the tents are caught on fire this afternoon.
Yeah, that'll probably be on the news.
Because the news reporter was there first before the fire department started.
Right.
You say a reporter was there, Russell?
Yeah, first before the fire department. I was the one dialing 911. And as I was on the phone, when did that propane little bottles blew up?
Or
hairspray.
Was this recently? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, that's
just before 2.
Maybe it was a celebration of some kind.
What I would deductive logic would say was probably they left a candle burning because nobody was there. And the last time somebody was spotted there was this morning leaving. And but at least if you're going to have a fire, it was in the right spot because it was right by the water and it's in the marshland. You know, nothing's really going to burn.
It wasn't actually on the Food Not Bombs parking lot area.
No, it was on the levee on the other side of the levee. Yeah.
Have the levee folks moved away at all, or are they still pretty much
good? Some people have moved and followed the Food Not Bombs.
We don't see any tents here yet.
No. I know. Somebody asked if we were going to move back to the post office. I don't think so.
We have to set up a second fence.
Oh, my gosh. Right? They would be like, what? They'd be like, we did that scene already. You guys got to come up with something new and inventive, imaginative. Keep everybody at least entertained.
How long has the meal been here? Since noon?
Yeah, I think... Because I sing every Wednesday with a group of veterans across the street, and by 11 o'clock when we're finished, we looked over here and he already had the red canopies up.
Wow. So you spent some time at the post office earlier?
Yes, in the memorial round, and I sing World War
II. Today is Wednesday.
World War II songs.
Is the Veteran Hall bureaucracy song?
No, they're good songs that all the soldiers, I think, sung during the wars, and some of the songs were sung in French and German with the same melody, same music.
Not, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier.
No.
That one didn't get sung, I suppose.
And I went to Catholic school, so you're a nun or teacher or nurse, and I did the teacher and the nurse, and then God hooked me up here to be a nun. Because I was supposed to make none, take none, and nobody gets none. That was my role here. And so it's been fun to be a nun in Santa Cruz.
Fun to be a nun. That could be the name of your fourth book.
Yeah, at least, yeah.
This veteran sing-along that happens every Wednesday begins at 10 o'clock right outside the, what do we call this place?
Jamba Juice is still there, yeah.
They probably going to give me like 10 hours.
Yeah, Jamba Juice and... And it's fun.
An hour a day. Nice looking chocolate donuts you got there. I got to warn you. That looks good. I'm going to have to go get one.
We get hooked up. We're ghetto royalty. I'm totally sure of it because yesterday we got all these fresh flowers delivered to Food Not Bombs. Like really, really pretty bouquets. A whole bunch of these beautiful bouquets. And I was like, wow. Now, you know, I might have been the only one going, wow. So I really take it personally that it was cool.
Team, they're doing a great job.
Oh, yeah.
They
cleaned up the levee because there were a lot of abandoned tents and a lot of garbage. There are no garbage cans. It's not the people's fault. The people put their stuff in bags, and there are no garbage cans. When we tried to use even the dumpster across the street over there where the crazy crab is or whatever, and they put their dumpsters in. So there's, like, no garbage cans out there for people, or they would use them. So anyway, kudos to Downtown Streets team is what Russ said, and I agree with him. That was amazing because we left, and it was a mess, and we came back, and we're like, oh, my God. And we talked to him, and it was him.
gift certificates for doing that.
You know what my premonition is? Is they at the end they're going to get a lump sum check of $10 more for every hour they worked, which would make it legal minimum wage of $15 an hour, and they've been working for five. So to pay them what the minimum wage is legally is another $10 an hour, and I think they need to take all their hours that they worked and then multiply that by $10, and that's how much of a big lump check that they get.
If they go on strike, I would agree that might happen.
No, it doesn't matter. They still get the money. They still get the money for every hour that they worked out here for $5 an hour.
They're not a union.
I know. That they should be, and then they get some decent wage.
They're going to take that Santa Cruz because I think the city and all the city maintenance and everything is going to shut down. It's like an overnight going out of business sale, I think, that Santa Cruz is about to embark on. And so I think Downtown Streets team is like the underground that rises, and they're doing great, and I think that they should be paid the other money.
I agree, although I don't think it's likely to happen. And we've been talking with...
This is Cooper, and they're all going on the Paradox.
What is your name, sir?
I didn't endorse this.
Certainly not. This was not endorsed. Thank you.
High time for a musical break. David Rovics again coming at you. Drink of the Death Squads. He writes, on December 8, 2005, New York University banned Coca-Cola sales from the campus. The administration was bowing to student groups who were campaigning to ban the drink on the grounds that the corporation supplied death squads in Columbia who were responsible for killing union organizers, among other crimes.
Cooking to Columbia, seeking lower wages. They got just what they came for, but as we turn the pages, we find the workers do not like the sound of their children's hungry cries. So they said, we'll join the union. They began to organize. So Coke called up a terrorist group called the AUC. Said, we've got some problems at the factory. The AUC went to the plant, killed two union men, told the rest, you leave the union or we'll be back again. Well, Coke did not complain about this dirty deed. Why give workers higher wages when Coke is all they really need? They phoned the AUC, said, thanks, without you we'd go broke. And to show our appreciation, here's 100 cases of Coke. The baby drinks it in his bottle and the water ain't no good. The dog drinks it, but he don't know if he should. Some folks say it's the nectar of the gods, but Coke is the drink of the death squads. Coke is the drink of the death squads. Well, these workers wouldn't take this situation lying down. Some went up to Georgia, said, look what's happened to our town. You American workers get downsized. As for us, we just get shot. And those of us who live, our teeth begin to rot. 'Cause the baby drinks it in its bottle and the water ain't no good. The dog drinks it, but he don't know if he should. Some folks say it's the nectar of the gods, but Coke is the drink of the death squads. Coke is the drink of the death squads. Now that's the situation. What are you gonna do? 'Cause the death squads run Columbia and they're paid by me and you. We can let Coke rule the world, see what future that will bring. Or we can drink juice and smash the state. Now that's the real thing. 'Cause the baby drinks it in his bottle when the water ain't no good. The dog drinks it, but he don't know if he should. Some folks say it's the nectar of the gods, but Coke is the drink of the death squads. Coke is the drink of the death squads.
The number of folks here at the meal is slightly less than I saw yesterday at the previous Food Not Bombs location. I'm talking about 10. We have several servers. Garrett, how do you like the new location?
I like this location currently because it definitely doesn't feel like we're hiding from anybody. I don't like this location if the city pulls out its stick and tries to whack us again and say we're not allowed to be here. But it's nice to be kind of by traffic where people can't necessarily drive by and just keep their eyes peeled straight, and they're kind of like engaging just by driving up next to us. So I like the clock tower right now. It feels like a good day, really good peaceful vibes, and I think we've served a good amount of people, probably not as much as back where we were before, which is a concern, but hopefully people
can
find
the location for the last week or the location for the last year.
Both, I would say. I think the location for the past week, the University Coffee parking lot, was a... I think we had most of the traffic there. Most of the traffic there that we had at Lot 27. And maybe we'll even be possibly able to move back to Lot 27 sometime soon. But I don't know. Yeah, it would depend on the city and how they feel about shipping containers and that sort of thing.
How long have you been at this service today?
I just got here maybe an hour ago, so not too long. I'm technically the closing driver for today, so I'll be closing up. We will shut down around 5 and likely load our stuff up. We're just going to figure out how we're going to do that. Here, I'm going to...
So what are your regular hours?
Regular hours are 12 to 5 every day. So we start at 12 every day. Hot food is usually out at 1, so 1 to 4 is a good time to tell people if spreading the word, because that's reliably when the food would be out. And sometimes we pack up at 4 because if we're out of food or just not a lot of people around, we'll pack up early. But so, yeah, 1 to 4 is reliable, but 12 to 5 is when we're out every day. And we'll be out every day regardless of where we are, where the city lets us serve.
I notice you have, I'm guessing, maybe 6 tables all in sort of a semicircular covered wagon, round the wagons kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, and plus there are 2 canopies, numerous Food Not Bomb signs, but no clothing table and no literature table.
The clothing table is over here.
Ah,
but it's around the... So that's, you know, mentioning that. I'm not sure if we're going to find, like, a different space for the clothing table.
The clothing table is kind of on the other side of the town clock. And it's sort of, I wouldn't quite say hidden away, but not as visible as the food service area. And it was still there some days later today, on the 3rd of February, when I came back and checked out the clock as I was leaving the Huff meeting. So there was a lot of clothing that was being distributed. It's a useful distribution point for people to, or drop-off point for people to drop it off. It can be distributed, and it actually gets to people directly. And I think it may not have the same problems, although I can't say this for a certainty, that let's say the People's Park free clothing bin has, and that some folks were reportedly taking clothing for resale purposes. This is sort of monitored by Food Not Bombs volunteers and in a very kind of informal way. And I suppose cliques can develop. That can happen too. But it seems pretty loose to me. But again, I'm sort of comfortable with the folks who are there.
I guess we were thinking, like, if we go raidily around the clock tower, we'd have it over there. But yeah, for right now, I only see a few shoes over there. So, and honestly, that's a little bit how the clothing usually goes around here. Is like, when we have clothes or books, it's usually one large donation, and then they show up and we put it out. But it kind of goes in a chunk, and then we're left without clothes for a while. So it's kind of a ebb and flow sort of thing.
And often you have someone on the clothing table, a number of people.
Yeah. Usually someone is behind the clothing table. Robin is really a consistent figure behind the clothing table.
Today.
Yeah, he might have left earlier. I don't know if he was here today, or hopefully he knew where we were. Usually Robin's back there or Joe's back there or something. But we basically have an unmanned clothing table at the moment.
Now, there was some controversy, I understand, at the Food Not Bombs meeting. Were you at that meeting on Monday?
No, I wasn't.
Well, I understand there have been some difference of opinion in the group as to whether to move here or somewhere else.
I don't know anything about the conflict, about whose opinion was in what direction. I've heard that people are hoping we could eventually move back to Lot 27, but I don't know if the city is going to try to keep it closed off for the foreseeable future, or if they just wanted to sweep us out and then let us move back after some time. But I'm not sure what the conflict was about. I can't really guess either, because I don't know where everybody else would be saying they'd want to put the
Depot Park was the issue for some, I understand.
Oh, they wanted to go to Depot Park.
One or two people at least, but
okay.
I'm just curious what if you had been there, because you're a sort of a stalwart of the group. At least I've seen you frequently there.
Yeah, I drive 2 days a week, and yeah, I definitely want to keep participating as much as I can. I think Depot Park. I don't know if this speaks to the conflict that was happening, but the fact that they just swept Depot Park a week ago makes me think that it would be unlikely a place where they'd be okay with us at least moving a shipping container and starting to serve. The other thing that I would think about Depot Park as against Depot Park is there's traffic over there, but I don't know if that's necessarily central to the layout of the city of Santa Cruz. So I feel like a lot of people would have to kind of make a pretty far hike to get down there. So those would be my concerns about I'd serve there if we were serving there. I wouldn't be necessarily against it.
What kind of response have you gotten from the people who have come to the meal today? I know you've only been here for an hour, but
I was talking to a friend that is a regular, and he was saying he really liked the last location, which I thoroughly agreed with. I think the University Copy parking lot is a fantastic one. There was a really good layout there and really good space, and it seemed like it was working really well. But I'm not entirely clear on whether it was specific. I'm sure it was the city telling us to move, but I'm not sure if it was started by the business owners not liking that the parking lot was being taken up. I'm not sure of the ins and outs of what was happening there. But yeah, mostly talking about that, but everybody seems to be pretty happy with the clock tower location. But there's also sort of like a sampling thing going on, because, you know, we only talk to the people who've made it out here. So, I think most people seem like they like this location, but I agreed with the guy who was talking about how the last location was a good one. I thought that was the best one. But the clock tower is really central, like I said, so it's good to kind of be next to people so they can see what's going on in their city.
How many people would you estimate have shown up in the last hour while you've been here?
The last hour, I would say specifically to come to the line to ask for food, probably 20, which is a little slow, but I'm the closing person, so that's not unexpected, but I'd say around 20. So, you know, that's we'd probably want it to be a little busier, but that's not like dead, you know. That's fairly regular for about 2:30. I think usually you'd have more of a rush kind of closer to the opening time.
What kind of food are you serving today?
Henry cooked today, so it's all vegan, and there's I think it's focaccia, sort of pizza type flatbread thing. There's a pesto spaghetti, there's a pasta mix in there, there's some mixed rice and white rice, then there's some peanut soup, which I think that's kind of my favorite every time Henry cooks on Wednesdays. It's like a spicy ginger Thai peanut based soup that feels really good on the stomach. What am I missing? Oh yeah, potatoes and sweet potatoes. So we have a lot of food today, so we're going to have leftovers. But
now
yeah.
A sensitive question. Do you ever suffer from any kind of stomach ailments after eating Food Not Bomb's food, or has that ever happened?
That's never happened to me.
You eat twice a week, you would say?
Yeah, I do. Never happened to me. The days that I eat are India Joe's had been cooking on Thursdays, and Henry cooked on Wednesdays. I know they both do a great job, so I've never. So, but I also I don't think I get stomach sickness too easily. So if that has happened to people,
you're a tough guy.
maybe in that regard, like eating weird stuff, I could see that possibly.
Well, I've run out of questions, but anything you want to add?
Thanks for interviewing people. I honestly got caught up on Pajaro Rising through listening to the interviews that you've done, so I appreciate that you go out here and do this stuff. It's great.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah. All right.
All right, Garrett.
Yeah. Thanks, Robert.
All right. I'm talking with
Stickman.
Stickman, you're making a comment about the reservation.
Yeah, we were just on the reservation in Fort McDermott, Nevada, Shoshone Paiute Reservation. It was horrible. It's like the world forgot about us. You know, the kids got no shoes, no socks, not eating good, no nothing. You know, it's just really sad.
How many folks are there?
There's about 400 on that res, Shoshone Paiute, and it was just really sad to see that the government cares more about their political ways and means than they do about the people. You know, we're all human beings. We all bleed red. We all hurt the same. We all live the same. We all have the same fears, anxieties, and pressures on us. But then for you to just forget about one class of people is just ridiculous.
What brought you back to Santa Cruz?
Well, I live here, but that's my tribe up there. You know, I went up and seen my aunt, and it was just horrible. It was very appalling. It was like walking down on the river levee where they have done nothing. No bathrooms, no sanitation, no showers, no nothing. And then they expect you to just move at a whim as they throw you around like loose change. We're human beings. We're human beings. We should be first. This building is made of sticks and stones and mud. If it blows up, somebody will replace it.
It's a money building. It's a bank, for heaven's sake.
Somebody will replace it, but if you blow up or people blow up, I can't replace them. So where do I put my value, in sticks and stones and mud or in human beings? I choose human beings.
Aren't babies replaceable? Isn't that what the Pentagon
says?
Yes.
We're replaceable because we don't have the income, the means, and the ways. But you have to remember that we pay the government's salary. They're living high on the hog, and we're living like a dog. And we pay their salary through our taxes. And every time we buy something to eat, that tax money goes to support them. And they're rich and fat, and we're here low and lonely.
What are we going to do about it?
We have to stop paying them. We have to stop paying the government to do a shittier job than they've already done. They don't think about us. They're greedy, and it's all about money. Once you got money, you want more and more and more and more and more. The people on the street just want to live and be left alone. You know, hey, I didn't choose this plight, you know, because of ways and means, the downtrodden, and the economy and all that, then now I'm to blame, and I'm a scourge of the earth because I can't afford to live in a house like you. I can't dress as nice as you. I don't have a car, and now I'm an outcast. Wait a minute. Ain't I a human being?
You can't afford the bill. You better move on, son.
Yeah. But they have all the money for the bill.
Yeah, but that's...
They have all
the
our
Lord
money.
The Lord has decreed it so.
Yeah, I don't think the Lord decreed this so. Not
so,
at all. He would be appalled. You know, if the Lord came to Santa Cruz, he would not go to one of these big, giant, frickin' ginormous churches they have. He would be right here at Ground Zero at the clock tower with the homeless people that know the plight of being humans that aren't supposed to exist. They want to just wash us away so we don't exist anymore.
And we have been talking with
Stickman.
Any other thoughts, Stickman?
That love is the key to all our problems. If we'll just learn to love each other and realize that we all bleed red, we all have the same hurts, wants, and desires, then we can learn to get along.
Any tips on how to learn?
Go help somebody who's less fortunate than you and put yourself in their shoes and feel how good you sleep at night knowing you got all this and that. You got 20 jackets, you can only wear one at a time. Why not donate them, you know, to people who could use it? You can only wear one jacket at a time. Why do you have 20 and 500 pairs of shoes when there's people with no shoes and no jackets?
You got to keep up with the latest fashions.
Yeah, I know, but But fashion don't feed us. And fashion doesn't love us. It's us have to love each other. And so we have to come to a compromise to where we realize that, hey, this person, shut your eyes. This person is just like us. No matter their color, their creed, their race, religion, whatever, they feel just like you feel about all your endeavors. And just because you got more money and this person has less, don't think yourself inferior. The Creator can take all this and wipe it away from you in a minute.
Not to mention the nuclear weapon.
Yeah, nuclear weapon. Yeah, because only horseshoes and hand grenades, you can come close, right? And now nuclear bombs.
And again, we've been talking with
Stickman.
And next, a couple of, here's one news story that's a little gloomy, sort of your standard reality check here for supposed justice in the courts against police abuse. This is Kentucky, Louisville, and it's from the San Francisco Chronicle's January 31st story by Dylan Loven and Piper Hudspeth Blackburn, neither of whom I have any acquaintance with. The only criminal trial to arise from the botched police raid that killed Breonna Taylor has begun, with hundreds of potential jurors gathering Friday at a courthouse in what activists see as a chance for some measure of justice. Individual questioning of jurors is scheduled to start this week. The former Louisville officer facing trial, Brett Hankison, was not charged in Taylor's death, but is standing trial on three lower-level felony charges for allegedly firing his service weapon wildly into the apartments of Taylor's neighbors during the raid on March 13, 2020. Whatever the verdict, the trial could disappoint protesters who took to the streets of Louisville for months as part of racial injustice demonstrations that exploded across the country that year. No officers, and this, of course, is the key fact, were charged for the shooting death of the 26-year-old black woman, and many see that as a tragedy, said Shamika Parrish Wright, a local organizer who was arrested at one of the Taylor protests. There are definitely people who want to see some form of justice and will take any piece of that, said Parrish Wright, who is running for Louisville mayor. We were asking for all those officers to be fired, arrested, and prosecuted. There have been murder convictions in two other cases that fueled the 2020 protests. In November, three white men in Georgia were sent to prison for the killing of Ahmed Arbery, a 25-year-old black man. And last spring, white former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin got 22 years in prison for killing George Floyd, you know, kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes. Taylor's death has spurred major changes. That's Breonna Taylor again in Louisville. Louisville banned the use of no-knock warrants. See, we're really helping out here. Like the one used in the deadly raid, and the governor signed a law limiting the use of such warrants throughout the state. I'm not familiar with the status of no-knock warrants in California or the practices of the Santa Cruz Police Department on this issue, and I should be. If anybody is and wants to talk about it, please call Free Radio or call me and we'll put you on the Free Radio on the net. My phone number is 831-423-4833. The Louisville Metro Police Department underwent regime change after the raid, and there is an ongoing federal investigation looking into possible racial biases within the department. The city also paid $12 million to settle a wrongful death lawsuit brought by Taylor's mother. But, and here's the issue that really sticks in some of our craw, the two former officers who fired shots that struck Taylor were not charged. Taylor, or I should say Miles Cosgrove, who state investigators said likely fired the fatal shot, was fired last January after Hankison was forced out. That's the guy who's on trial for shooting into the next apartment. And Jonathan Mattingly, who was wounded in the leg by a bullet fired by Taylor's boyfriend, retired last June. The Louisville officers were serving a no-knock warrant at Taylor's home as part of a series of raids that night targeting a drug dealer and former boyfriend of Taylor's. But he wasn't with Taylor that night, and police found no drugs or cash in her two-bedroom apartment. The warrant police used to enter her room was later found to be flawed. During the raid, Henningsen fired 10 shots through Taylor's patio door, according to an FBI report. Three of the shots went through a wall that connected to a neighbor's apartment. If convicted, Henningsen faces 1 to 5 years in prison for each of the wanton endangerment counts. And that's trial begins for officer in fatal raid of Taylor home. Of course, not the one who killed Breonna Taylor. And that's by Dylan Loven and Peter Hudspeth Blackburn in the January 31st SF Chronicle. Now time for more Rovick's educational music. This song apparently is called Free, F-R-E-E. On December 16th, 2009, Jeff Lewers was released from prison in Oregon. He had served 9 years of a much longer sentence for taking direct action against climate change through the less than conventional means of setting gas-guzzling SUVs alight at an SUV dealership. Although people frequently get only a few years in prison for burning down someone's home, if the arsonists are ever caught, if the property destruction is politically motivated, the prison sentences are generally many times higher, as was certainly the case with Jeff Lewerts.
A land of houses and rows. I had asthma. That's how it goes. When you're in L.A. and there are cars everywhere, see the sky and smell the air. I left home, looked around, trying to find some solid ground. I found life in the northern wood, and I knew that this was good. I saw the dozers, the death machines, tearing apart everything green. I built a platform, sat in a tree, said if you're taking her down, then you're taking down me. I saw the highways, I saw the mall, I saw the eagle, heard the clarion call. Voices of reason were talking to me, so I burned down a couple of SUVs. Among the words and the deeds in the war for the West, a chapter was written, and I was the test, to shut us all up and drive us apart, all who have life and love in our hearts. The judge did the math, then he did some more. He was a man out to settle a score, an illegal sentence in a stolen land, with life or death in the palm of his hand. And now, here I am, so long behind bars, for trying to breathe in a nation of cars. Sanity jailed, and madness in power. Our time it is short, and now is the hour. So may you hide in the darkness, and stay safe in the night. Find whatever you need to stay in the fight. There's a planet at stake. That's all I see. And my thoughts will be with you until I am free.
Well, I think that one deserves music, but of course it doesn't have it. Because it doesn't, we're going to play When the Shooting Ended. On December 14, 2012, a young man went into his local elementary school in the Sandy Hook neighborhood of Newtown, Connecticut, and killed 26 people, including 20 small children. It was only one of many similar massacres in the United States that year and every other year since.
Higher. Girls didn't like him. He did not know why, but he announced before his rampage they then deserved to die. Each time he squeezed the trigger, so many bullets flew. Each time they hit students, bodies fell on cue. The assault weapons ban had expired years before. That's how this boy got access to these weapons of war. When the shooting ended, there was congressional debate without the slightest change of course for the ship of state. The shooting ended. When the shooting ended, it was just a few years later, 1,000 massacres between another state, another school, a mind impossible to glean. A privileged young man killed his mother with her gun, and then long before the morning was done, he drove to his old grade school before the clock had time to tick. Huddled in a corner were the lifeless 26. Six adults and 20 children there 1 minute and then dead. Drowned inside the classroom in a thick sea of red. When the shooting ended, they said the nation was in shock. But the Congress could do nothing to take away the Glocks. When the shooting ended. waves around them sank as they all realized they were like fish inside a tank. Completely defenseless in the room where they were placed, as one by one, three by three, the young lives were erased. One more man's wishes could hardly be denied. 49 lives later, he committed suicide. They talked about his mental health, how he used to smoke hash. Meanwhile, in D.C., the lobby handed out the cash. The shooting ended, politicians whined and dined. Yes, the NRA made sure their pockets were realigned. When the shooting ended, when the shooting ended, the shells rained down from the garage, far more from the hotel, and in churches that were turned into a fiery hell. Post offices and cinemas and so many living rooms where what started as a party ended as a tomb. Even right-wing congressman on the firing line from his hospital bed, he mindlessly repined, the greatest country in the world is the USA. Just make sure to bring your gun when you go to church and pray. When the shooting ended, the president and the mayor said the victims and their loved ones were in their thoughts and prayers. Shooting ended. When the shooting ended. When the shooting ended.
So now here's an interview that I did earlier today with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. Some of it concerns the issue of the internal, I guess we'd call it, dispute resolution approach that's used. It's often pretty makeshift. Some would say it's dictated by Keith McHenry. Others would say it's dictated by circumstances and pressure from food servers who are concerned as to what to do. This has nothing to do with the instances of violence that happened with respect to Sammy, specifically the most recent one regarding the punch in the face that happened after, I think there was some confusion in that Dread Eye would thought that Sammy was, who was angrily talking to Keith, was threatening Keith, which Sammy, I think, denied. And then he tried to pull, I think he punched Sammy in the stomach or something. I'm getting different accounts. Apologies, Dread Eye, and apologies, Sammy, if this is inaccurate. But there was, at which point Sammy supposedly retaliated with a punch in the face that did opened up Dread Eye's face a bit. He had to get a couple stitches, which I think they were able to do with some makeshift CVS stitching patches. But Dread Eye's back on his feet. Sammy has been apparently mellow for the last few days. And here's the discussion. I kind of began with a question from one of our Huff participants at today's meeting, and we'll start there. And you get to hear Keith's account of a number of things, but that's some of where we start out. So the next thing is, I'm skipping the phone call for the moment. Last time, I guess, Monica, were you here last week?
Yes.
You may remember that we had a sort of a lengthy presentation from Laura Chatham, who is a former Food Not Bombs worker, who is very concerned about how Food Not Bombs is being run and how some people are being treated there. And she spoke at great length off the record, actually, but it's not off our record because, you know, she talked to us. And if she were here, I would talk more about this. I don't have too much more about it, except I did interview the people that she quoted as having problems, a guy called Sammy and a guy called Tyler, and also Keith McHenry, who they had the problems with, or they had problems with other people in the group, too.
And Dread Eye.
And Dread Eye, yeah. And so if people want to hear about that, though, they should go to the Sunday show, which is the first part of the Sunday show, or to the Tonight Show, the Thursday show, which we'll have more on it as well. There's not a lot to report. You can hear their
their accounts, how they regarded everything.
And at this point, I had hoped that some of what you couldn't hear at the beginning of this show, which was blown away by the wind, would actually be audible, but it wasn't. So we were stuck with some of the earlier accounts, and this is Keith's account coming up soon.
What happened according to them? This is sort of internal stuff.
According to who?
Tyler, Samuel, and Keith.
Andretta.
And other people, too. Mm-hmm. I think Garrett also talks about it. There was a dispute about...
I heard all about it, yeah. but I know that he's out of the hospital.
Oh, yeah, Dredd. Yeah, he was looking better, actually.
But what I wanted to know, and I wanted to know if he was going to call in from here, I wanted to know if this guy Sammy is in jail now.
No. He wasn't in jail yesterday.
Yesterday he was at the meeting.
But he did say he was meeting with his probation officers today and that they might jail him.
And
apparently Keith told me on the phone that he had contacted the probation officers and asked that they direct him to stay away from Food Not Bombs. He was at Food Not Bombs yesterday. There was no violence. Nobody complained. They were having numerous conversations. I was there for half an hour. But, Food Not Bombs goes on for 4 hours, so it's hard to make a full sense of what happened.
Are you going to go down to the food he wants?
No. To the Food Not Bombs? Yeah. Probably not.
Okay, because Jedi wanted some vitamin C.
We can drop it off, too.
Okay. Okay.
So that's what that's about, at least insofar as we have current information.
Did you want to talk to Keith?
We can call Keith and ask him. Talk to him about other stuff. I try to separate these two issues because internal Food Not Bomb stuff, though it can be important because, I think all of us favor open policies.
All right, Keith,
you are on. Did you want to say something, Coral? Keith, you're on. You're being recorded here. Watch out. And that's for broadcast. We got a relatively large congregation of Huff members here. Gail was just asking about, the usual sore point. Did you want to ask your question directly, Gail?
I want to know if Sammy was going to be put in jail so that people don't have to worry about his violence at Food Not Bombs anymore.
If he is ever violent, all the volunteers have agreed to call the police and have him. I don't think that's going to be a problem.
Hang on a second. I'm trying to up the volume of this. This is very, very low. Can you cut this up?
Okay, I'm going to... There we go.
I'm sorry, say that again, Keith.
So we're at the town clock, we're having kind of a zero tolerance thing on violence, and my agreement with the probation department and with Sammy himself is that if he's ever violent, we're going to call the police and have him removed. And then we've also been doing that. We've decided temporarily anyway to do that, any violence that happens there. And just to see. But so far, Sammy's been really mellow since this confrontation. So that's been really good.
Yeah, I was there yesterday, and that's what I saw.
Yeah.
For the limited period of time I was there, of course.
Yeah, I know, and he and his brother, and we've discussed a lot, and I talked to his probation officer who was appointed. I mean, Sammy's first meeting is today with the actual officer, so hopefully all this will go well.
Okay, well, we have a more controversial subject, which has to do with one of the... I don't mind saying it's Garrett because he was quite open about it. He was expressing doubts about, it's fine to evict someone for violence. He was concerned about him being evicted from the food, him and Tyler being evicted from the Food Not Bombs meeting by police on Monday, which is apparently what happened. Is that accurate? Did he?
Yeah, we did that to break up this crisis and put it to a head, and it worked so far, and it was successful.
But you don't intend to be calling the police on nonviolent people who maybe have been violent in the past, in the future, or is that going to be a new policy for Fudnabomb's meetings?
No, we're unlikely to ever call the police on a meeting again.
Good.
Yeah, it was just for the purpose of that one. There was definitely a disruption, which was too bad. But the main point, you know, so we were trying to shake up the situation so that all this stops, and it seemed to have worked. So, you know, and I hugged Sammy's brother and said he's welcome to come back to any meetings tomorrow, you know, in the future. And he and I have got a really good connection, even though I explained to him the need to remove him and Tyler from that particular meeting. And it seems to have shaken all the stuff that we've done to try to end the disruptions, and so far seem to be working.
What's happening? Let me shift a bit to the issue of no further problems with the city or the county or the health department. Is that correct?
Hey, Wilson.
Correct, yeah. We don't have any problems currently with anybody.
When I can get a ride back, I'll eat it. But if somebody wants it, they can have it. I'll be there about 12:30.
So, additionally, any reports from other Fudnabomb's folks or other Santa Cruz Homeless Union people around the, around the state is what I'm interested in, but anything that comes to your mind you think we should know about?
Yeah, I don't know anything about that, no.
Any words?
I'm not completely engulfed in what's happening here right now.
I got you. Is there any...
What about the bulldozer?
Gail's got a question. Why don't you tell him, Gail?
Is there a bulldozer going on right now at the Benchlands?
I haven't been over there. I know that somebody... This is all I know. I haven't been to the Benchlands in a bit. I guess we're delivering our food again. I haven't talked to Joy yet to know what's happening with that. But I do know somebody burned two portable toilets completely so they became a molten thing of plastic on. And they were up high because the trucks couldn't get down into the Benchlands itself. And then a bunch of people lived near those before they were melted things, and they got tags put on them 2 days ago that they had to leave, because the tents were up on the higher ground. And then I was told, but this has not yet happened, that Justin and our little food distribution thing up by the bus stop on Water Street was supposed to be moved back down to the Benchlands, but that had not happened yet. And so I don't know. That's all I know, but I haven't been over there, so I don't know. I just thought people that were there told me these things.
Okay. Free, you have a question or comment?
Hi, Keith. It's Free. Any updates on Chris Dione, Commander X's status in jail?
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Well, we're trying to do a petition to have the charges in Orlando dropped. Orlando was supposed to present whatever their case was, and that was supposed to determine what the what sentence he would get. And he's almost to the point where he might get credit for time served if that all goes well. But we still can't seem to get the federal prosecutor in Orlando to communicate with the judge in San Jose, at least the last I heard. I mean, maybe that's changed the last few days. And, and he's out of isolation finally about a day or two ago. And then next court appearance act keeps getting changed, in part because the federal prosecutors in the case, in the Orlando case, we're still not communicating with our lawyer and with the judge in San Jose. But those cases are supposed to be put together, and somehow you know, and it's back and forth as to what's happening really with those, with that. I don't know, you know, hopefully something will.
So he'll remain in Santa Rita jail until he has his next court appearance in San Jose?
Oh, yeah.
Correct, and then eventually he'll be sentenced to a federal prison somewhere. Probably, although maybe he will. It's supposed to be federal, you know, it's the FBI that's it's federal prosecutors that are doing the case. So that's that. We don't really know.
What about Santa Cruz County? Did they get a verdict on him hacking the website there?
Not yet, because it's part of the, you know, there's two cases, and there's United in this case. So, yeah, I think the basic idea is to only plead guilty to the Santa Cruz thing and
take care, man.
And to drop the Orlando thing, but I'm not sure what's happening with that.
Is there anything I can ever do?
I'll call you, too. You got my card.
That's me, yeah.
Go ahead, Keith.
Okay, that's all I know about that.
Nothing from Pajaro River and the homeless union down there. What's going on? Anything you heard about?
No, I don't. I mean, I know they're being harassed, have to move around, trying to find places and doorways, you know, the regular. But otherwise, I don't know any details of that. I can tell you at the town clock, which is, of course, where I've been mostly organizing, and that we are, I'm actually currently working on a flyer for the neighbors. We're actually having some luck. So they're attacking us, right? The people that are in the condos are trying to kick us out of the town clock. But we've had a couple of conversations with them, and it seems like we're starting to at least weaken some of the resolve. And I know the person that... So yesterday I was called by somebody in those condos who said that, you know, that there was a guy with a bunch of trash sleeping at the town clock. That was terrible. You know, it's going to mean that all these people are going to start camping at the town clock again. You're just attracting people there and so on. But she did admit that she was impressed that we were mopping the entire plaza at the end of the meal. And then I explained that Tony was taken away by the police right when we arrived. But then he returned at the end of the meal, and that I had spent roughly 2 hours total during the day trying to encourage him to sleep somewhere other than at the town clock.
And we'll hear about the conclusion of this conversation after a little music. This song is called God's Gift to the Caliphate, and I think actually I played this some months back, but I think I'm going to play it again. On December 7, 2015, presidential candidate Donald Trump announced that under his administration, Muslims would be banned from immigrating to the United States. After that, he started appearing in more Islamic State recruitment videos, naturally enough.
He was born a rich man, then he got richer still by bribing politicians on Capitol Hill, by declaring bankruptcy, by working with the mob, by causing lots of Americans to lose their union jobs, by exporting industries to sweatshops overseas, by acting like an idiot on national TV. But now add to his accomplishments one more impressive trait. He's God's gift to the caliphate. God's gift to the caliphate. In between his beauty pageants and gambling casinos and pretending to be a self-made man in films and TV shows, Donald Trump decided he should run for president for jihadi recruiters. His campaign was heaven sent. It's a war between religions, a civilizational fight. That's what Daesh says, and Donald Trump says that's right. All you Muslims, stay out of here. Just go join Islamic State. He's God's gift to the caliphate. God's gift to the caliphate. He's not much for statistics, he doesn't have the time, between harassing women and committing corporate crime. But he's a savvy gambler, he knows how to play the game. He's got a list of groups ready made for him to blame. He doesn't just hate Muslims, he hates Mexicans as well. And he's prepared to win the contract for the wall he wants to sell. But the terrorists around the world think he's really great. He's God's gift to the caliphate. God's gift to the caliphate. The future of the world may be technically unknown, but if the past is any indication, then Trump has set the tone, along with 27 governors and Congress people by the score, who, if we turn the clock back to 1944, would be turning back the refugees just like we did back then. Hey, that worked out so well, why not just do it all again? Because what the world clearly needs is more bile bombs and hate. And God's gift to the caliphate. God's gift to the caliphate.
Like even over at the post office, from my perspective, although I think the people at the condos would probably not like that. But anyway, just a little, so it wouldn't, you know, be. And of course, he was very severely. Challenged with probably what appeared to be methamphetamine, and could not communicate at all. So
is this Portuguese Tony you're talking about?
Yeah, Portuguese Tony. Oh. Yeah, but then he walked away at some point yesterday, leaving a big pile of trash which we had to discard. But this woman wanted us to stay there and come by. Wanted me to take Tony away from the plot. From the town clock, and I encouraged her to meet with me to speak with Tony to see what her impression of our ability to do that. Mm. And I also explained that we had, like, basically, I could have somebody hit him with a piece of rebar, like, as hard as possible. I could then also, but that was probably not legal, and and it's not something really that Freedom Bombs encourages. And then the other one is that I could have the police remove him, but the police did point out to us that unless he's committing a crime, he is, and Tony himself, when he is lucid, and I have had these discussions, and I totally agree with Tony, that he's an American, and he's allowed to be in public space at any time, no matter how weird he is and how much he can't comprehend what the hell's going on. But that's his right, as long as he's not stabbing somebody or burning a building down or whatever. She also claimed that we were tracking Tony, but Tony himself, before he, and it was arrested last week before we arrived for setting a fire in a little park, Stoops Park or whatever, across the street, and he was held for a week in jail before we even got there. So, you know, it's dishonest to say we are why Tony's there. He's been arrested there repeatedly recently since he wandered away from Lot 27. Actually, I think he's been a month in jail at one point, and arrested for some, I don't even know where, but he was absent from Lot 27 for a long time, and we had to throw all this stuff away 3 or 4 months ago from Lot 27 because it was rotting and gross. And so then, and he didn't show up for weeks, so anyway, that's that. And then also another person was very angry and claimed when we were there before, we had left trash everywhere, and then I got kind of angry at him. I said, no, I actually took photos every night when we did it Monday through, Saturday and Sunday, because somebody had dumped household garbage there and then took a photo of it and then made a change.org petition to get rid of us. So we made a very concerted effort to make sure there was no trash anywhere around the post office or the town clock, and I would take photos every single at the end of each meal to prove that, and so it was all posted, and we posted it on Facebook every Saturday and every Sunday for probably a couple of years. And
has that happened recently?
He complained that while it sustains on the ground, So that's why we started mopping up anything, you know, clean, making sure there's no stains. And then Coyote Steam Cleaner, we're paying him once to come there once a week to do a thorough cleaning of the entire area. Where food is dropped. So,
is that new, Keith? Were you doing that before at any point?
Well, we had asked him to do the area where we were setting up at the town. At 27, I was willing to pay him on a regular schedule, but he decided he didn't really want to do it as a regular thing, but he did come by and do it randomly. So I'm hoping every Wednesday he will come and clean the entire area, and then between Wednesdays, I think he's hired to come on either Saturday or Sunday by the city itself to do the whole plaza, and then the town clock, and then so at least twice, I don't know if that might be monthly, I think is the city's contract with him, and he does it on a week, one weekend a month, and then we're hoping he does every week, and best would be, you know, on a regular thing like Wednesdays, and then we're going to just do it in between ourselves. Yeah.
Any other questions for Keith?
Do you know the names of the two people who called you to complain about Tony?
Person called to complain about Tony, and then the other person is a man that walks by every day and talks to us.
You know,
and he's actually getting more and more supportive. You know, after I got really mad at him for saying that we left trash everywhere, because that was the first minutes we were there.
You know the name of the first person that called?
No, and I don't know either person's name, but they're not the famous woman that
you asked.
Coined the term Take Back Santa Cruz.
The Janet person?
Yeah, Janet Fournette. Yeah, it wasn't her. I haven't seen her anymore. There's a possibility she didn't make it through COVID or through the last couple of years. But her husband does go by randomly every once in a while, Jerome or whatever his real name is.
So, Keith, I think Free has a question for you.
Oh, did you go back to vegan again? I heard you were serving meat.
We only prepare personally as Food Not Bombs vegan food, but because there's been, you know, Joe was helping us a lot, and he's very militantly pro-meat, we kind of said, well, okay, you can do your meat, and then he recruited a close friend of his to do meat in his place, but at some point we're going to go totally, probably when we go back to just 2 days a week, you know, Saturday and Sunday, we'll go completely back to vegan again, as far as not even allowing meat to be, you know, delivered and stuff. But right now, it's like a, you know, with the pandemic, it's been a nightmare because you just, you know, random people come with sandwiches from here, there, you know, during the fire, for instance, we're getting all the FEMA meals, you know, stuff like that. It's been, like, really crazy. So it became, like, kind of, you know, our policy became, well, whatever we make is vegan, and we serve vegan food. But whatever randomly happens, you know, we'll just have to live with it during this chaos.
Served separately or something, so you can tell?
We let people know, but we don't really exactly, you know. Yeah, so what has happened before COVID is you could have the food meat donation sent to St. Francis or, you know, or Lawton Nelson. But then when they don't really exist as any kind of substantial meal program, so that's why that happened. And it was the chaos. But no, I mean, and a lot of Food Not Bombs chapters that evolved into this kind of chaos around the country are now slowly moving back into 100% vegan as COVID restrictions in different places.
Is Joe Schultz still serving food? Because I know his restaurant was, of course, taken over by this, hotel complex demolition?
His building is actually being destroyed by another corporation out of Delaware, who is registered in Delaware, who has a mailbox in Sandy, Utah. And it's like it appears from the best research we've done that it's just a hedge fund that bought the property from Owen. And so that's what's happening. So they got a several-story condominium project that spans from the parking lot. I don't know how far down it goes. I haven't been down there since. It definitely is taking out the building that Joe is in. I don't know if it's taking out the paint company next door. Now, the other project where we got kicked out of, the reason we're kicked out of Lot 27 was because of a treated sewage project that's for SoCal Pure Water, of all things. What a name, Pure Water. And then that physical space, there's somehow a problem with the credit union about finding a new location, and their building's supposed to be destroyed, and then tall luxury hotel projects by development out of Manhattan or somewhere in New York, I think it's Manhattan, is supposed to go there, called Cruise Hotel. So that's what's happening there.
Is Joe Schultz, getting back to my original question, actually?
He does help us, but he isn't really, now our meals are all prepared at the Little Red Church. Because he's kind of in a chaos trying to figure out how to get his catering business going. But he does do things like supply us with coffee, and he does supply us, we still got not only our refrigerated shipping container up at his place, but he also has the walk-in that's set up and going there. So there's still a lot of coordination, but he's not technically preparing meals anymore for us until everything shakes down.
Any more questions for Keith? Any questions for us?
No.
Any answers?
Thanks for reminding me. I'm working on this flyer. I was writing an essay instead. I should get back to the flyer.
All right. Yeah. Well, then we'll end it here.
Everything should be peaceful at the town block. I guess the other announcements are, looks like a band is going to set our normal band, Johnny and the Lovers, this time. We'll be setting up on Monday, Valentine's Day, the 14th, at the town clock. And then after that, we have the two-year anniversary of Serving Every Day called Thank You, Santa Cruz. We could have done it without you. And that's on Sunday, March 13th.
And I understand you're announcing a protest against the increasing escalation of tensions between Russia and the U.S. around the Ukraine, right?
Yeah, I guess from my perspective, it's against the U.S. threats to go to war with Ukraine, but for Code Pink, it's trying to be even-handed, and they announced the Global Day of Action. And not that I'm a Putin supporter or anything like that, because actually Putin's secret police were apparently involved in agitating neo-Nazis to attack Funab bombs in St. Petersburg and then Moscow and then Siberia, where we've had four of our volunteers killed. And we had to do a global petition campaign against the Putin administration to get them to actually apprehend and prosecute the murderers in these cases. So we're not all palsy-palsy with Putin by any means, but I think this fight for whatever war, potential war, is totally a fabrication of the United States.
I tend to be sympathetic with that viewpoint. When does this protest happen?
And that would be noon on Saturday.
At the town clock.
At the town clock, correct.
So are people going to be, shall we say, eating beans and rice at the same time? Is that the plan?
Well, once the beans and rice and all the food arrives at 1 o'clock, they can take down their signs against the war and
chow down.
Chow down.
Excellent.
But we will have coffee and water from noon on. Uh-huh. When the protest starts.
Sounds good.
What's that?
There you have it. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye
bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for your service.
Hope you heard. And thank you for yours. Now comes the song "Free Abu Saka." On December 14, 2015, a young circus performer named Mohammed Abu Saka was arrested at a checkpoint outside Ramallah by Israeli soldiers. He was a passenger in a van on his way to a concert. Without being charged with any crime, he was held in detention in Israel for 9 months and then released. This happens to thousands of Palestinians each year, including children. Sounds a bit like Santa Cruz and other prisons in the United States holding people because they can't pay for the bail. But probably he was being held without even being offered a bail, but I don't know. Here's the song.
Another artist was arrested just after the 100th anniversary of Joe Hill's execution, which I'm sure was coincidental. He was on his way to a concert in Ramallah and was removed from the van he was traveling in and told that he was under arrest for, and he was not told what the charges were, and he's being held in what they call administrative detention. And at any given time, there's usually about 700 Palestinian, mostly young men being held in administrative detention. It's the same policy that Britain used to have in Ireland in the early 1970s of indefinite detention without charge, which was what fueled the rise of the IRA. The particularly outrageous thing, perhaps, on some level, of this man's arrest is that he's 23 years old and he spent his entire life basically juggling and riding a unicycle at the Palestinian circus school in Birzeit. His time is all very well accounted for because he's pretty much a total geek and he spends all his time juggling and riding unicycles and teaching children how to do those things. And he doesn't have time to be blowing anything up or whatever. And all the people at the circus school are quite convinced that his arrest was due to the fact that he was making too many children happy, and they don't like that. He grew up in Jenin, where his neighbors lived and died. With the things he'd seen, it was pretty cut and dried. He could have been a fighter, as so many others did. He could have become a martyr, like so many other kids. Instead, he joined a circus troupe to warm the aching hearts. Sometimes a hula hoop is the best way to play your part, and his only crime was making children happy. His only crime was making children happy. He grew up playing football and other things like that, but outside his house's walls, he'd play with alley cats. He would teach them tricks with passion and with purpose, so no one was too surprised when he went and joined the circus, stopped by soldiers every day just to do a show under occupation. That's the way that you have to go. But his only crime was making children happy. His only crime was making children happy. He grew up to be an artist, to perform and to inspire. He got on a list, just living will draw fire, of the occupation soldiers who took him in December, who now hold him in detention, because he is a member of a troop that has been trying to keep hope alive in a place of death and dying, juggling to survive. His only crime was making children happy. His only crime was making children happy. Artists are to be feared, every dictatorship knows. Sometimes killed or disappeared, or just banned from TV shows. But with military rule, there's no explanation given. They point the gun, you keep your cool. They take you off to prison. In 6 months, they decide whether to keep you or let you out. At no point will they confide what the charges are about. His only crime was making children happy. His only crime was making children happy.
And now another tale of apparent official malfeasance, which might cause us to look into our own, or should say their own, Santa Cruz City and Santa Cruz County behaviors and court behaviors here. And the story is surcharge for traffic violations challenged by Carolyn Sade, and it's also from the January 31st San Francisco Chronicle. When the notice that he owed $860 to San Mateo County came in the mail in August 2021, Anthony McCree, 28, had no idea what it was about. He'd finally gotten housing and some temporary work after a period of being unhoused and was working to rebuild his life and his credit. How am I going to pay this on top of all my other responsibilities? He remembers thinking about the hefty bill, more than half his monthly rent. This is going to put me in the hole even more and keep me from getting financially stable. Eventually, McCree discovered that the bill dated back to April 2019 when he was on the way to a job interview at San Francisco International Airport. He had exited BART at the airport station through the emergency gate so he could use the ad fare machine to put more money on his Clipper card. A police officer had detained him but let him go. He says the officer didn't hand him a ticket for fare evasion, and because McCree was homeless at the time, he didn't get one in the mail either. The maximum base fine for fare evasion is $250, but the original fine had ballooned into $860 because of a policy in San Mateo Superior Court that automatically adds a $300 surcharge onto traffic infractions if the defendant misses the deadline to pay the fine or contest the ticket. McCree's ticket had other fees added as well. And that, of course, is also the policy. I can tell you from numerous accounts that I get from people who've had sleeping van tickets and other infractions, the courts are happy to find you guilty in absentia if you don't show up and then send the ticket to collection with an additional $300 fine. This, of course, denies you the right to confront your accuser and have a trial. And I've often asked Steve Plaich to consider taking a case like this, which he always says, oh, yes, I'd be happy to do it if someone came to me with the case, but I haven't been able to do that. And I've been somewhat skeptical about this response. But I sure hope somebody assists people who are struggling against this unjust form of extortion that doesn't help the community, certainly doesn't help the victim, and it simply serves to fund, looks like to me, court corruption. Now McCree, in San Mateo, is a plaintiff in a lawsuit filed Thursday against San Mateo Superior Court, saying that this policy to levy a civil assessment fee on minor traffic violations violates people's right to due process and displays a blatant conflict of interest. Essentially, it's a hidden tax on those that can least afford it, the case says. Moreover, because people of color are disproportionately stopped for traffic violations, and of course people who are poor were disproportionately ticketed for sleeping van violations and are still facing similar, what I would call poverty tickets, it discriminates against them, the case says. McCree, who is black, said he's acutely aware that there is an element of racial profiling when it comes to fare evasion. Neil Taniguchi, court executive officer for San Mateo Superior Court, said in an email that it does not comment on pending litigation. Let's keep our mouths shut about this one, shall we? Manuel Galindo, an organizer with the nonprofit Debt Collective, another plaintiff in the case, sees the court's policy as another step in the criminalization of poverty, since people who can't afford their original tickets often are socked with the extra fees. Recent studies show one-fifth of Bay Area residents have less than $400 in savings. Individuals fall into this financial trap the courts create of charging them more for being unable to pay for something in the first place, he said. I've met people who went hungry to pay their fees because they were afraid of what it meant if they didn't pay them. It is devastating to communities. Even a $25 base fine for jaywalking can trigger the $300 surcharge, said Zal Schroff, senior racial justice attorney at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights of the San Francisco Bay Area, which is bringing the case along with the ACLU Foundation of Northern California, Bay Area Legal Aid, and Fenwick & West, LLP. And it's worse than that. It's not just a small fine can trigger a large fee if you don't get to court or pay it. If, for example, you got a $20 sleeping ban ticket, in order to avoid going to court, you would have to immediately pay off a $198 ticket at the window before going to court. This was 2 or 3 years ago. So the apparent low fine of $20 is actually a fine of nearly 10 times that, in effect, about 10 times that, which is about $200. And then you would add to that $300 if you don't pay that and you don't get to court and have to deal with that. In the past 3 years, San Mateo Superior Court has brought in $9 million from the surcharges, reaping $3.4 million in net revenue, the case says. I wonder how much Santa Cruz courts are getting for this. Courts send the surcharge money to a statewide trial court fund, and then they can keep everything above $2.1 million a year after collection expenses. During the past 3 years, San Mateo charged the full $300 in more than 80,000 cases and sent more than 100,000 to debt collection, including cases that predated the past 3 years, the case said. San Mateo isn't the only court where this happens, you can say that again, but it is among the most egregious, Schroff said. No judge or other human weighs in on its surcharges. They are automatically added by computer, he said. Its notices about them don't tell people they can challenge the surcharges or give information about potential grounds for doing so, he said. And that's the same with Santa Cruz, as far as I know. They do mention that people can say that they can't afford a ticket, but don't explain that the $300 can be challenged separately. California lawmakers created the surcharge system as a way to help fund courts in the 1990s, shortly after the state's three strikes law led to a huge increase in judicial caseloads. Rather than allocating more money in the budget, the legislature authorized courts to upcharge people when they missed deadlines for traffic citations, the case said. With 5 million traffic citations annually, it proved to be lucrative. Statewide, courts have generated more than $750 million in the past decade through civil assessments on traffic citations, the case said. But the effect on low-income people has spurred some action. Governor Gavin Newsom's 2022-23 budget proposes cutting the maximum civil assessment fee in half to $150 and allocates $50 million to backfill the loss in revenue for the courts. Galindo from the Debt Collective said he's encouraged that the governor recognizes the toll that surcharges take on marginalized people. How sweet of the governor. This says how grave this civil assessment is, he said, of the budget's addressing of the issue. It hurts families and communities. Again, this is traffic fine surcharges challenged. January 31st, 2022, San Francisco Chronicle, a story by Carolyn Said, or Said, perhaps. And here's another article that caught my eye. Drug use allowed at New Tenderloin Center by Mallory Munch and Kevin Fagan, January 26th, Chronicle, this year, in San Francisco. San Francisco is allowing people to use drugs in an outdoor area of Mayor London Breed's New Tenderloin Linkage Center in United Nations Plaza, interviews and Chronicle observations confirm. And I'll just begin by noting this is Breed's latest attempt to remove visible homeless people from the streets by forcing them to get into a so-called navigation center that navigates people nowhere, has no housing navigation, but pretends to, similar to what Santa Cruz does with its Housing Smidgens, Housing Matters, I'm sorry, or is it Housing Mutters? I don't know. But that's the relatively well-funded nonprofit center at 115 Coral Street. Continuing of this story, Several people told the Chronicle in interviews Tuesday that they had used drugs inside the fenced-in area bordering the center's entrance on UN Plaza. In addition to the outdoor area, the city offers basic hygiene services, food, clothing, and connections to services such as treatment and housing on the first floor of the seven-story building. They keep, of course, endlessly repeating these claims without ever giving any stats of how many people actually get to housing and how many people get dumped again or simply remain there until they're edged out by new people. The mayor's spokesperson, and again, get dumped on the street. The mayor's spokesperson, Jeff Cretton, says in an email that the emergency initiative is about doing everything we can to help people struggling with addiction and getting them connected to services and treatment. Of course, there's no indication of how successful this is, how many people are reaching services through this. I would tend to even consider it, even for a moment, more seriously if there these kinds of statistics were included. As part of that, the Linkage Center is serving as a low-barrier site to bring people off the street. I would say to swoop people off the street and to force people off the street because of complaints of open drug dealing on the street. They'd prefer to see it happening in more private situations. And I can understand that. I suppose, in a way, it is a form of reform, except, of course, it now comes under attack because any drug use, of course, is a sin and a crime. Well, it is a crime, for sure, because of our medieval laws, or their medieval laws, I should say. The revelation that people are using drugs at the week-old site was first reported on the Substack newsletter of Michael Schellenberger, an author who has criticized progressive policies in San Francisco he sees as too permissive. Addiction experts and advocates differ on whether allowing those who struggle with substance use disorder to get high at the site will help them to get connected to treatment, with some saying it is acknowledged as a necessary reality on a journey to get help, and others calling it counterproductive. Schellenberger accused the city of running an illegal drug consumption site and a supervised drug consumption area, which is currently illegal under state and federal law. But San Francisco and New York, particularly New York, is trying it, and Breed supposedly was going to try it, Mayor Breed, but chickened out after last summer, I believe. I don't remember the exact reason why she chickened out. Probably because of concerns from people like Schellenberger. Francis Zamora, a spokesperson for the Department of Emergency Management, which is running the Linkage Center, denied the city was operating a supervised consumption site. San Francisco is working to follow New York City in opening such a site, which would provide medical supervision and clean supplies, despite its questionable legal status. Even if city officials are turning a blind eye to illegal drug use, they're unlikely to face legal liability, said Robert Weisberg, a Stanford law professor and co-director of the school's Criminal Justice Center. Quote, prosecutors have almost unreviewable discretion not to bring a charge, Weisberg said. I don't think anybody would have standing to complain, he said, because it would be hard for an individual to show he or she was injured by San Francisco's actions or inactions. Last month, Breed announced a state of emergency in the Tenderloin in a bid to reduce overdose deaths and said, that's, of course, the official line. Yet real reality is they want to get rid of people on the streets that are visibly engaging in drug activity or just being present on the streets and being poor in the streets, as they were trying to do by setting up tent cities a year ago or so. And she said she wanted to crack down on drug dealing and use in the neighborhoods. She said people using drugs in the streets would be told they had a choice of going to a Linkage Center or jail. But that didn't appear to have happened, probably because they don't really have enough beds and facilities in San Francisco to overrule or to meet the requirements of the Martin versus Boise case, which says if you ain't got the beds, leave the people alone. The Department of Emergency Management and the Police Department said the day the center opened that social workers and public health workers were leading the outreach to get people to the center, but they were not being arrested for refusing to go, at least for now. So far, police have not stepped up patrols and arrests in the Tenderloin, although the mayor has indicated she still wants to do so when staffing and the budget increases. And so as more money is provided for police departments, of course, they use their money. Journalists are not allowed inside the linkage site. That's kind of interesting. But a Chronicle reporter standing outside on Tuesday observed several people in the fenced-in area holding drug paraphernalia, including foil and lighters used to smoke fentanyl and pipes used to smoke meth. Three men with foil said they were glad to have a calm place to use drugs. Others were also appreciative, saying they could connect with the center's services while taking advantage of a more private place to use drugs than the sidewalk. Kayla Simpson, 28, sitting outside the center in UN Plaza, said she went in January 18th, the first day the center opened. While waiting in the fenced-in area, she said she felt the need to smoke, so she did. They were cool about it, she said Tuesday. Schellenberger, author of the new book San Francisco, Why Progressives Ruin Cities, wrote that two people who did not identify themselves as journalists entered the site and took videos of people using drugs in the fenced-in area while city contractors working at the site stood by. When asked by the Chronicle what happens if someone tries to use drugs in the outdoor or indoor areas of the linkage center and whether staff will allow the practice to continue, Zamora did not answer directly. Quote, "This site is about getting people connected with immediate support as well as long-term services and treatment," he said. "Part of being a low-barrier site means bringing people in without asking a lot of questions." I suppose implicitly that means not arresting them for using drugs, because if you're trying to connect them with services and you're telling them this is a place to go, they aren't going to stay unless they can continue to do what they're doing outside until such time as they can get treatment. And there's nothing in this article that talks about the availability of treatment, of course. Other city staff and nonprofit contractors interviewed at the center Tuesday gave a similar answer about a low-barrier site. City Homelessness Department spokesperson Denny Machu-Grieb said the area is not a supervised consumption site, but if people overdose, at least they're right next to staff that can help them. Since the center opened, staff members have reversed three overdoses, the city said. But these overdoses might be the result of someone using drugs prior to entering the site. No one interviewed mentioned using drugs inside the building, only in the fenced area. People can come into the center and stay as long as they like. The center is open 12 hours a day now, but will expand to 24 hours. Fentanyl users on the street said they sometimes need to use every hour to avoid symptoms of withdrawal. Those who embrace the city's harm reduction policies said that allowing people struggling with addiction to use drugs at the center makes sense. Brooke Lober, director of harm reduction at St. James Infirmary, an organization that supports sex workers, said she wasn't surprised by the reports people were using drugs at a drop-in center. "They remain welcome there, and I think that's how all services have to be if they are appealing to people that if they use drugs," she said. "The alternative would be to kick people out or otherwise send them on their way. The norm of these places is we're trying to meet people where they're at." Lober said her organization does not support coerced services and has condemned the city's law enforcement crackdowns and homeless sweeps, because homeless sweeps are what followed the opening of this center. Dr. Josh Bamberger, a clinical and family medicine professor at UCSF, said that allowing addicts to use drugs in a safer situation than on the street or the sidewalk is generally preferable, though he didn't comment directly on the linkage center. He said healthcare workers who help people addicted to drugs in street settings are in a similar, often difficult situation because users may want to get high in front of them to avoid getting sick from withdrawal. Outreach workers may offer medication-assisted treatment, such as Suboxone or methadone, but an addict may not want to accept on the spot, Bamberger said. Tom Wolf, who was formerly addicted to drugs and is now a recovery advocate, said he visited the center Tuesday and was discouraged when he saw people using drugs inside the fenced area. "I'm not saying prohibit drugs totally because people will have it on them. I'm just saying don't let them use inside," Wolf said. "I respect what they're trying to do there, but if you're going to allow someone to come in with a bag of dope and use it, that's not good. How is it going to work if you walk up to someone who just smoked and say, 'Hey, do you want rehab?' That's not going to work. You're messing with that guy's high. How can you engage him at that moment?" Keith Humphrey is an addiction medicine specialist at Stanford University School of Medicine who has advocated for more treatment options and supported the mayor's promised crackdown on open-air drug markets, said the city should not mix active drug use with people seeking treatment. If you're coming into a place that's supposed to guide you toward the end of seeking treatment and recovery, and there are people using drugs around you, that becomes an incentive to keep going, he said. It's like trying to have an AA meeting in a bar. And of course, there's truth to that, but the reality is this is not a treatment center. This is a concentration center to try to get people off the streets while at the same time apparently meeting, or trying to appear to meet the Martin versus Boise guidelines. So they have to have something that they have to have beds for people to go to. And it's not really a treatment center. And so if you want to really do this without people just leaving and then having to be arrested because people are on the streets, obviously they're willing to risk arrest because they're on the streets anyway. It's kind of a false front, in my view. Some people who use drugs said there were few alternatives, getting back to the story itself. It's not like they're advertising it, but what are you going to do when you're waiting around and you need to use, said Ray, who does not provide his last name, as he sat outside the center Tuesday. If someone overdoses in there, they can help. What's wrong with that? Ray said he had smoked in the fenced-in area at the Linkage Center on Monday and that staff members were cool with it. He went to the center to get rehab and housing and planned to return. Trent, who also did not provide his name, his last name, said in an interview in the plaza that he had smoked inside the fence on Sunday. They were very professional about it. That's kind of like a safe site now because it's partitioned off. We need that, he said. He said he went inside looking for housing, rehabilitation services, medication to treat drug use, and tools for harm reduction, and was hopeful he would get them. It's very impressive, he said. I saw hopeful stuff. You probably heard hopeful reassurances, too, and I guess it's nice that this sounds like the beginning of essentially drug use injection center kind of area where people can use safely or more safely and with some more privacy than on the sidewalks. And that would be good. At least that's what I think. So here's a final interview with, I call him Goat Guy Kevin. He calls himself that too. He's a guy who lives in the Benchlands, or actually right above the Benchlands, but is being evicted back into the Benchlands. He used to be right near the place where Huff and the Santa Cruz Homeless Union would meet every week. And he kept a number of animals, goats, chickens, dogs, and he got flooded out. And I did a brief interview with him, I think it was a week ago, maybe. I think you could probably find it on an earlier show. And here he is again with an update. It's the 3rd of February, and we're closing on 11 o'clock. I'm talking with
Kevin.
And Kevin, you're here with a number of pooches, a number of goatish-type creatures, and who knows what else.
Yeah, my goats are, they make me happy when skies are gray. My dogs and my goats.
You were noting that even the good times is talking about the value of stuffed animals. You're thinking about real animals as companions and also actually economic assisters.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Pet therapy is a real thing. You know, I'm a psychology student, but I know enough of the subject and it's well known. Like the Good Times reported that, pets they increase our oxytocin, which helps us tolerate pain and just feel good and have empathy for others. And that's one thing these pets do. They don't just make me happy. I mean, we walk around and they get a lot of smiles and I like to hear, "You made my day." I get at least one of those a day when I walk with my pets.
Well, I know that this is a change from your rather pessimistic mood when we last spoke.
Yeah, you know, I have my mood swings like everybody else, you know. I'm still a little frustrated that I couldn't grow this thing by now like I tried to. You know, the pet therapy is just one angle of it. That's what you do with your young and your young goats that you want to socialize, because it's a two-way street. You know, it'll end up making the animals more friendly and more gentle, so that when they're big 200-pound creatures doing their wildfire prevention work and their landscaping work, that they're still easy to handle and put on and off a trailer and walk around, you know. So yeah, I'm frustrated. It hasn't, you know, I haven't gotten that contract yet, but but I'm still staying upbeat. And if it never grows past, you know, my pets bring others happiness, then I can be happy with that.
And in fact, we should tell folks, because many, I mean, I know who you are, and regular listeners probably do too, but and regular Huff attenders and regular California Homeless Union people, because you were often at their meetings when they were held in the benchlands or the upper benchlands. But this is, of course, we're sitting on a bench overlooking the encampment and the benchlands. You were somewhat discouraged by the fact that there weren't any actual contractual arrangements being made in the mini encampment you have that would allow a smaller group of people to protect each other, watch each other's property, and so forth.
Yeah, that's been my gripe. If, you know, I could be free to voice it with my neighbors who I love, but yeah, just to be able to assemble a solid group of more than we got here. You know, we have two, maybe three here. But seven is, to me, the magic number, you know, 7 to 12. And that's how I envision my goat camps, too, when we're out there doing
it. Anybody doing that here in the benchlands that you know of?
So I think some might be, I think. I'm not sure of everybody's group's arrangements, you know. But, you know, that's one I tried to establish and still, you know, still trying. But, yeah, we're getting moved again.
Tell me about that.
Well, we had to come up here to the higher ground when we got flooded down there. And, yeah, so we set up here. I think that was beginning of December or end of November. And then, yeah, so now we got to move back down there. So
you've been told you can't stay on the higher ground?
Yeah, we got the orange stickers. Yeah, we have to. This is, I guess, the city property here behind the bus stop. And, yeah, we got about 7 tents here, but we got to break them up today.
How long have you got to move, and when did these stickers appear?
I think it was 2 days ago. And then we got a pre-warning a week before that. And I think today and tomorrow are the days we have to move. We might even be a day late at this point, I think.
I've gotten the impression, based upon conversations with Brent Adams, as they cleared, apparently, or should they, I don't know if they bulldozed or just harassed away or demanded that people leave the Camp Paradise area, the area next to Felker Street, that they were sending people down here and crowding out accommodations again. What's your sense of that?
Oh, the population here has definitely grown. You know, where there was one row of tents on each side in the beginning, you can almost see they're three deep now.
The dog?
But it's been definitely a peaceful transition with a lot of people, you know, mixing around again. I haven't seen a lot of fights and heard a lot of fights. It's been pretty peaceful, so I think we're kind of getting used to this.
You used to get out a lot. You were, and perhaps you still do, walking the goats or feeding the goats on the grass or helping the grass get clipped by the goats. Do you still do that?
Oh, yeah. I kind of got shut in for a little while with the bad weather. You know, that we had with that rain, you know, we had to kind of stay in, couldn't do that. So, yeah, I'm hardly ever in camp. Yeah, I definitely like to roam around all day.
And how about your connections with folks? I know you were frustrated that people were not getting in touch with you through Google, that there was just not a sufficient kind of interaction and communication and actually commitment to a longer-term project that you were concerned about.
Yeah, that's true, but that's partly my fault too. You know, I don't work a computer like I used to, and I guess I don't network and lead and organize like I used to back in my contractor days. You know, I forget that was 12 years ago, and I guess my personality has changed a lot since then. You know, being in solitude a lot, or you know, and being off the grid and out of the economy. You know, so I'm more about, you know, accepting that now and then just being appreciative of, because I've had a lot of help this last week or two. Richard's walked all the animals with me up to Emmeline and then out to the library where somebody can sit and watch them while I go use the internet in there. You know, that's One thing is a theft. You know, you get a lot of complaints about that, and I have to say, I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm up to like 12 devices. It's an average of a device a month. I can't even.
Do you have a phone currently?
No. And in fact, I have to make all my doctor's appointments through email and HPHP and three different contact. But it's almost better. You know, 2 months I haven't carried a device, and I'm satisfied with that because I don't have to worry about charging a device, losing a device.
I know one of the reasons you didn't want to take a chess set that was offered to you, a small chess set, was because, again, it was another responsibility having to keep an eye on it, that sort of thing.
Exactly. You know, it's like I was at one time on a cross-country road trip. I didn't have a single pet. It was after my dog died. And I had my whole possessions down to 58 pounds, or one single backpack, and that was a way to roll. You know, I like traveling.
Did somebody take your backpack?
Yeah, that got lost in Baltimore. That got confiscated in Baltimore.
I want to talk to you more, but I've got to get to the Huff meeting. If you can find somebody to bring you and your goats over, you're welcome to come join us.
Oh, that sounds good, but I got to do the library to get a birth